We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
I mean, I think it's a paper crane, but I feel like somebody refers to it as a swan at one point,
yes.
Which is weird. Apparently our ornithological accuracy is somewhat
big
in jeopardy.
Words.
What was our number? 736?
Well, let's not, hold on. Let's do it when we do it.
We'll do it when we do it.
We're going to call the number that Michael sends to her.
We're going to call the number and see what happens. Sorry, I cut you off. Go for it.
Not at all. No, you didn't. You did not. All right.
Okay, we have no guest this week because we have stuff to talk about.
So much stuff.
And next week we have a guest that I'm very, very excited for, actually. Mm-hmm. We have one of our regular cast members who we love so much. So we'll just dive into the Kalstein Index. Episode 205 was titled Map 1213. It premiered on September 18th, 2006. It was directed by Peter O'Fallon, beautifully. Written wonderfully by friend of the show, Karen Usher. Ratings-wise, the episode delivered 9.55 million live viewers, which was actually a season high at this point. Competition in the 8 p.m. time slot was Wife Swap on ABC, Deal or No Deal on Competition.
You're doing great.
8 p.m. Thank you. I'm knocking it out of the park. Was Wife Swap on ABC, Deal or No Deal on NBC, and on CBS, they had a brand new pilot for a new show called The Class, which I don't remember.
I think if The Class is what I think it was.
Yeah.
I'm too lazy to look it up. It was one of the funniest pilots I've ever read in
my
life. And I believe it was sold by Noah Baumbach and Steve Martin.
Wow.
And that it was about, I may be conflating all these different things, about an acting class.
So like a proto-Barry type thing?
Without the murder, like just a straight up all the crazies in an acting class.
Dear God. Okay, that's intense.
I may be making that up. Okay.
Okay, but I'm going to go with it.
Yeah. To recap the episode, Tweener's road trip crush finds out who he is and allows him to steal her car and run. Michael and Lincoln
and
arrive
heart.
In Tooley to find Westmoreland's money. They go to City Hall to find the blueprint of the land where it's buried, but someone else has already taken the map. T-Bag runs into them. Hi. And tells them that Tweener has the blueprint, but when they track down Tweener, he reveals that T-Bag had it all along. We won't say where. T-Bag then memorizes the blueprint and eats it.
Eats it.
So that the brothers can't kill him. Meanwhile, Sucre goes to Maracruz's wedding in Las Vegas, but things go sideways. He ends up heading for Westmoreland's
yep.
money as well, as yep. does C-Note. Mahone finds out about the money and that everyone is converging on Tooley. During all of this, Kellerman, yours truly, is blocked from Boom. Direct contact with the VP by Reggie Lee, Agent Kim, and ramps up his friendship with Dr. Sarah. Governor Tancredi begins to believe in Lincoln's innocence.
In pop culture news this week, on September 23rd, Barry Bonds hit a homer against the Brewers, surpassing Hank Aaron's record for National League career home runs. At the U.S. Open, that's tennis this week, Roger Federer won his third U.S. Open and ninth Grand Slam title, and the 19-year-old Maria Sharapova won her second Grand Slam title. And on September 18th, the CW Network made its debut as the successor to the WB and UPN networks, which had recently shut down after 11 years of broadcasting. And they combined their programming for the brand new fledgling CW, which is still with us. And you were on the CW, right, Paul?
Nope.
No, I'm sorry. You were on the WB.
Nope.
Weren't you? I thought you were on Gilmore Girls.
No, my ex-wife was on Gilmore Girls.
I sort of feel like you were on it, too. Okay. You were never on the WB?
Nope.
Oh, fine. I was on the WB.
Are you confusing me with a short blonde lady?
I mean, if the shoe fits. Okay. No, I...
Her,
for
I
some reason...
never fit
you
her
guys
shoes,
did,
which is why it didn't
you
work
guys
out.
Did so, you guys did a bunch of shows together, though, right? Didn't you both...
No.
You were both in Scandal. You were both in...
We were both on Scandal. She was on Private Practice once. We were both on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is Sherman Palladino. I mean, I did one. She did a few of them. But I think that's it. We never worked together. I don't think we've ever worked together on camera, but we did meet doing it. And in global events, September 17th was the first global day for Darfur, with tens of thousands of demonstrators in 42 cities around the globe demanding the UN peacekeepers be sent into Western Sudan to stop the genocide.
Sudan, not Sudan. Western Sudan was left alone. The peacekeepers could leave her alone.
I did not say Suzanne. Earlier,
you said Suzanne.
On September 12th, the Pope, not from our show, sparked fierce reactions from Muslim communities when he quoted a centuries-old text describing Islam, sorry to laugh, but this is just so ridiculous, as evil, quote, evil and inhuman.
Well done,
end
Pope.
Quote. Hope he walked that one back. And on September 13th, in the U.S., the Senate Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to approve the National Security Surveillance Act. I feel like they do this every week in our recaps, allowing the NSA monitor international phone calls and emails to U.S. citizens without a warrant, and everything has been fine since. So,
and that's how your phone knows when you order Uber Eats.
I received...
I'll see myself out.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll talk about the episode.
Welcome back.
Speaking of being
stuff to talk about.
Spied on, I received a Farm Fresh box yesterday of, you know, that you, instead of going shopping, they bring
right.
you, and it's cheaper and it's better. And there were beets in it. I don't know what to do with beets. So
you
I chopped
put a
them
melody
up.
Over them.
Oh my God. You're such a dork.
Dad jokes all day long. Dad jokes all day long.
I didn't Google it. I just chopped them up. You know what? Now that I think about it, I may have looked on my New York Times cooking app and just put in like beets. And then my Instagram feed was just beets recipes.
No, really?
I don't like that. I don't like it.
I hate
that. Leave me alone.
I hate that. Also, nice transition from cooking with Paul into Lance and his pie proficiency, whatever you call it.
Yeah. So
this is a fun episode. Do we want to start or end with the phone call?
So there's a let's do it right before we do fan questions.
Okay.
Let's do it right.
I'm very excited
it.
About this.
So just to tease you, there's a scene in which Sarah is in her apartment and she gets quite a bit of mail, and in there is a paper crane in an envelope with no message, conceivably from Michael, and there is a phone number inside it, and we're going to call that number because it is not a 555 number.
What happens?
Seems like a real number. Although Kellerman then sneaks through your mail creepily, gets the number, traces the number,
committing a felony,
and is told that it is never been, that it's been out of service for some years, and it was never belonged to anyone. As he walks down the street in his oddly large jeans,
and I did not think they were oddly
his
large,
oddly
but they
shaved chest.
Did you shave your chest for this?
For a very specific, well, for two reasons, but we can get into it later. Also, I wanted to ask,
can we get into it now?
No, we can get into it in the
episode. Okay, wait,
where
wait.
You burn my chest with an iron.
Okay, so we can't talk about your chest hair right now. That's fine. We can put a pin in that for later.
There are those things where you're like, oh, I've been wearing a suit on the show in its entirety. Right, and then suddenly you're in civilian clothes and you're like, I'm just going to make a decision about this. And I don't remember why it was. And I was like, he's not going to have that. It just doesn't seem very Kellerman-y for some reason.
Really?
Yeah.
And so it was your call entirely.
Well, and then I don't know if we had read I think the next episode is when you burn me with the iron. But that also was a whole thing about chest hair, too. Which was that would have been
the next episode.
Which not?
I don't think so. Okay, I think it's down
the stream a little
bit. Then
I must have just made
that
weird decision. There was another thing we talked about. I don't know. Maybe I don't think this is inappropriate at all. We talked about last episode. This is the episode where Kellerman, Lance, tells Sarah that he's gay.
Yes.
And whether that was on the fly or not. Now watching that scene.
Totally looks on the fly.
Definitely on the fly.
Totally on the fly. Yeah. But a great pivot and done sufficiently subtly that it's buyable.
Yeah.
It feels really plausible to me.
Yeah. I feel like nowadays, he maybe would have said, oh, no, I'm gay.
Yeah.
As opposed to just said, my partner, Daniel. We talked, I think, last time about, you're playing, Kellerman's playing another person. Is there anything, I made a conscious decision, obviously, not to "quote unquote, play gay, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
Character in any kind of characterization. I did one thing in that scene though that I thought would help convince Sarah, or at least make Sarah comfortable, and kind of do that thing, which I don't even know if it read, but it felt comfortable to me to be Lance. Anything?
What's that? One thing?
Yeah, I did one. I had one physical thing that I decided to do that I was like, this is what Kellerman would do, to be like, I'm supposed to be gay. I want to make sure that, even though he's not overdoing it, hopefully, or.
I'm super curious. What was it?
I crossed my legs. In a way that.
In the scene at. In the scene at my apartment.
Like, in a way that, just wouldn't imagine. I crossed my legs like
it's
that.
It's a very un-Kellerman position.
I just don't think he seems so athletic and special forces-y that I don't know, I always thought of being kind of always in ready position, so of folding myself up like that felt also unthreatening. I mean, I'm so overthinking it now. I don't remember overthinking it at the time. But I remember
but I do remember shooting that scene. I remember too. I also remember loving the choice that you made, and I felt that way again when I saw it, when the governor comes into the room. That, it's almost like you can see Kellerman going through in his head, have we met?
Have we met?
Would he recognize, have we ever been in the same room? Would he have been briefed? Like, is this... It's one of the few times that you see something that Kellerman did not expect at all come at him. And it's interesting to watch him in real time flip through the Rolodex in his head going,
like, how do I,
what's the
how
plan
do I
here?
Handle this?
Oh, there's no plan here. Yeah, which was kind of cool. I also remember they built that set on a sound stage.
Yep.
And I made a note about this, the color of the walls. I can't remember. The color of the walls is Tiffany blue. It's the same color as a Tiffany box.
Well, I'm either having a deja vu or this was actually discussed at the time or something.
I can't remember who brought it up, if it was the production designer or if it was me, but I know that since then I have asked for that color on the walls in different locations as both a director and an actor, because there's something so evocative. Like, I think it must have been Phil Leonard, who is our production designer, who was like, she's the governor's daughter. She grew up with a Barney's card. She's still
a little fancy.
She likes the little blue box, and so it's the color of her walls. And I just
love that.
Kind of loved that
and
detail.
Does it work?
It's also a beautiful color.
And as a director, does it work? It must be a very, I don't remember noticing it, but a warm, it's blue, but it's a warm blue in its way.
It's a robin's egg blue. Yeah, it's a robin's egg blue, and it's a wonderful color.
I wanted to ask you about the scene in the NA scene in the church.
Yeah,
I'd worked with Peter Fallon before, like one of my very, very first things.
The director, Peter O'Fallon. Yeah,
and he's a very no nonsense, like flip guy. Like, I remember shooting a scene. It was a group scene on a show I was in Chicago, and I didn't even know I had done my coverage. Like, he didn't even.
It was just like
what they call hosing it down. Like, the camera's just whipping all over the place. Or he'd put the camera on you and have you do your two lines in the scene like seven times each, which I do not like.
That is not my favorite way to work. I will be honest.
Favorite way to work. Although I will say, I don't know if I'm getting too off the point. Somebody who will remain nameless, but who is a genius actor, is in the latest two Mission Impossible movies and told me that they shot some scenes like that.
I actually once had an actor ask me
to do that.
Because it was a very, like, I'm trying to get out of here at a certain time. And they were like, instead of multiple takes, can I just say it five times? Because it was, you know, it was like a medical show and they had like one line in the background. I was like, yeah, for sure. I was like, I feel like an asshole director. He's like, I'm asking for it. I was like,
Stories about De Niro trying to having to say the same line over and over and over again. This is less that.
But anyway, I say that because
Peter is a very experienced TV director, and so much about TV shooting is about time. But he was the first director I ever worked with who would not cut and go back to the top of a scene. And we were still on film.
Oh, that's an expensive choice.
Well, it's
I loved it. For
because
sure.
Because our fans, when they say cut, no matter how fast
the cinematographer comes in,
how fast you say we're going to go again right away. Everybody, there's 100 people there who have a job to do, and that is their moment to do their job. They're going to fix
hair and makeup steps in, wardrobe
steps in.
They're
going to fix the thing in the background that they noticed. They're going to put that light is a little too bright, or there's some dust over on the thing.
Sound's going to adjust a wire.
And if you don't cut, no one can do anything. And so once the transition to digital happened, where it's just ones
everybody
and zeros, now you're going to be like, but Peter was the first guy I ever remember saying, prepare to do two in a row, which I did. When I started directing, it was still film, and I would always be like, we're doing two in a row.
Yeah.
And I loved it as an actor because you get such little runway anyway that you didn't.
Yep.
I'm not great at keeping my concentration sometimes after cut. I'm a little scattered. So nice to stay in it. And that's the first scene I ever remember doing.
Yeah.
He'd just be like, reset, and we'd run back and do it again.
The one thing about it on film, was a couple of times I remember rolling out. Mm-hmm. And that's frustrating when you're like, and now we can't use it. Because a rollout is when the film runs out in the magazine. And so you hear up. And you're just like,
you can use it until that point.
Yeah, you can. Until shortly before.
Digital run out.
I don't remember him. Yeah, that's weird when the card is like, well, the card's full. I have no memory of Peter O'Fallon.
Kind of
absolutely
longer
like,
gray hair.
We had so kind many hair, directors. Yeah. I'm sure he was a super nice guy. I just, you know, there were so many. And I was at the point where I felt like the people with whom I was building the scenes were my acting partners. Like, I was trying to build scenes with you, certainly with John. John is such John Hurd, who played the Governor Tancredi. Like, such an amazing, accomplished actor. So totally easygoing.
I would also say that Peter, which is a certain kind of director, doesn't, he's not interested in direct, especially series regular actors, not interested in directing them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
He's
that's
very
your
much
department.
He's very much a that's your department. Story guy. Did we get the beat? Does the shot make sense? Are you happy with it? Moving on.
Oh, interesting. You know, I feel like we had a lot of people who had that approach as a director, especially on Prison Break, but particularly season two, where it was like, okay, the actors know their characters. They know the story. And the story is now huge. We're going to be in five locations that are 2 hours away from each other. We've got big action. You know, like it was no longer... Yeah. You're shooting five people in a prison cell.
Yeah. And
digging
I would also
a hole.
Imagine that the mandate from the writers, like when you have a production meeting when you're directing episodic TV, the executive producers say, okay, this scene, make sure this story point comes across. Mm-hmm. Make sure this story point. The in a way, they're more cinematic and visual now than they were. Like it's less a lot less about the actors have to deliver this piece of information, and it's more just kind of emotional scenes, I think, because of the scope of the thing.
Yes, go.
No, your turn. Your turn. I've been talking too much.
No. I had a note about Reggie Lee.
Yes.
Because you guys had your first scene together.
Yes.
And
I love that guy.
He's wonderful. I think I end up killing him. I think I shoot him.
Really?
In season four. It was one of the last things I shot, I filmed.
Go ahead.
It was a long time ago. But, I mean, you worked with him a lot, right?
A lot. We had a really nice, and he was the guy, you know, there's this great thing. I remember when Miska came in.
Mm-hmm.
There is a thing where it's a meta thing where you're like, oh, this, the character is trying to bump my character, like out, right? Like,
oh, that's right. You mentioned this with,
But also you're like, is this person actually trying to take my job?
Right. Right.
Like not the actor, but like, do they want this character?
Are the writers replacing,
me?
Kellerman. Yeah.
So there is this kind of competition, but Reggie and I got along great and, stayed in touch for quite a while. And, we should have him on. He's a great actor.
He's done some great work.
He's done some great work. And he did a great... He had an... I think more than anybody else, he's the only one who could go smug to smug.
Oh, my God.
With Kellerman. Like, oh I feel God. Like we would just smug each other.
His like smug Mahone's smile? Thing,
yeah. And Mahone's thing isn't smug. It's different. And Danny certainly wasn't. And... Miska certainly wasn't. Well, a little bit. Yeah, I don't know. That was the smug off.
It was the smug off. Yeah. It was the smug off. It was the smug off and the glasses off and the car off in the
and
very
the suit.
First scene.
And the
like,
and the,
Caroline's talking to me now, not you. It was very, it was fantastic. No, he was a big, he was a great addition to the show. And so was Bruce. Bruce Bennett, played by Wilbur, whose last name I can't remember. But, you know, it's interesting that, like, they just kind of drop people in. And then if they're good, they keep going.
They come around,
for such a long time, like Barbara Eve Harris, who we talked to recently. I want to tell you a story about borrowing a phone.
Yes.
Just because it came up. Here's why it came up. This is not germane to the show, but this just kind of cracks me up. So we were watching the scene where C-Note is on the train. and he asks to borrow the laptop of the woman sitting next to him.
Yeah.
Who, so he can check his email. And we were noticing that that doesn't happen anymore. If somebody said, "Can I borrow your laptop?" My answer would be a hard no.
No way.
But you mentioned that you had borrowed someone's phone.
I was getting my phone replaced a few years ago. And it was suddenly not going to, it was like, it'll be ready in an hour. And then it was 2.5 hours or something. And I had to go, I was supposed to pick up my daughter.
Yep.
And I needed her mother to pick her up. And it was literally one of those things where it's like, I went to the Whole Foods and literally said to somebody, "I'm sorry,
can I borrow your phone?
Can I borrow your phone?" Just to make a phone call.
How did they take it, by the way? Because it's an interesting
ask. Well, and then they recognized me.
Oh. Did that make it better or worse?
Better.
Okay. Okay.
Better.
The guy from Prison Break just borrowed my phone.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the very short version of the story here. And I'm telling this partly because it relates to phones and borrowing, but also because it relates to crime. So a couple of years ago, there was somebody who was casing my house.
What?
And I called it in, which is very unlike
your
me.
House,
but there were
now?
Yeah, the house I'm in right now.
That's a hard house to case. You're in the woods.
Well, and I have 300-pound dogs that surrounded him. And his reaction to the dogs was what told me that he was bad news.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, this is, and I was home alone. And so I did something that I've never done really before or since, but I phoned the fire chief, who's a buddy of mine. And I was like, "Hey, I think I'm being paranoid, but will you just come down here and tell me I'm being paranoid? I'm home alone. My husband was on a search and rescue call out and completely unavailable. Kids were at school." And so the chief comes, sees a vehicle parked at the end of my road, calls it in. It had been stolen the night before. Can't find the guy. Long story short, the guy then breaks into my neighbor's house, has an altercation with my neighbor. They like straight up fisticuffs. The guy is bleeding from the head, escapes on foot into the neighborhood. Here's how he's found. Because he escaped into this little park that lots of people hike in. Some hikers were coming down the trail, and this guy who's bleeding from the head goes, "It's an emergency. Can I borrow your phone?" And they were like, "Oh my God, sure. He's clearly injured." Into the phone, next to them, he says, "I'm in such and such town. You've got to come pick me up and get me out of here. The cops are looking for me." Hands them the phone back, takes off on foot. They look at each other, call the police, and are like, "Hey,
this guy just said,
are you looking for a guy bleeding from the head?" And they're like, "Yes, which way did he go?" And they came and they apprehended him. But it was like,
holy cow.
Of all the dumb crime stories, the fact that he basically turned himself in to a couple of hikers just slayed me. We're like, not every criminal is Michael Scofield. Right. Like, some of them are not masterminds.
Right.
That was my borrow a phone story.
The brake light was out. Speaking of phones.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Should we call this number?
Yes. Can you do it?
I can. Because I feel like bad things are going to happen.
Nothing bad is going to happen.
Should we say what the number is? I guess anybody who's watched the episode can know the number.
Absolutely. The number is,
I'm looking up what the area code is, by the way.
736.
It's in the U.S., northwest suburbs of Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Hey.
But the first number that comes in, it's the country code for Sudan.
I would not call Sudan.
I don't think
that could be very expensive on your plan. Or Suzanne.
1-736-339-8687.
Put it on speaker, please.
Your call cannot be completed at this time. Please try again later.
Okay.
Shales.
I'm going to try from my phone and see if
it's
calling from
Canada
makes any difference. 1-736-339-8687.
I thought we lived in the time where all numbers were taken because of cell phones and fax machines.
Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the number and dial again.
Come on.
Well, that was anticlimactic.
Very. We should have done. We should have made something up.
We should have had our producer Ben pick up the
right,
phone.
Right, right, and pretend to be
like, "This is the Milwaukee Brewers
right,
office."
Exactly.
I don't know why I said it in that
either,
accent.
But that was good.
All right. Should we take a break and then come back for some fan questions, or did you have more you wanted to talk about from the episode?
I mentioned it in the episode, but I just thought it's hilarious that Tweener has a huge gothic LG tattoo on his arm, which is Lane Garrison.
Lane Garrison.
And they obviously just
maybe
made the decision.
Maybe I call in for the. I think our call in question for the week should be:
what does LG stand
what does
for?
The LG stand for?
It's not Lane Garrison.
I'm going Little Gangster.
All right, let's take
a- I mean, because people usually don't have themselves tattooed on their shoulders. So I, when I saw it in the show, I was like, oh, I totally buy that this is something that Tweener would have.
Ah.
You know?
I'm not a tattoo person. Do you have any tattoos?
I got a tattoo a month ago in Lisbon, yes.
A month ago?
And that's all I'm going to tell you.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Break.
Quick break. Fan questions.
Now break.
We'll be right back.
And now we're back.
All right. Hello.
Okay. You guys, fan folks, fishes folks and friends. I put something on the Instagram that said we were going to talk about this episode, and you sent some fun questions here. Our Instagram is at Prison Break Podcast, for those of you who don't know. So the first one from at Stephanie Reed 4732. What's your favorite line or scene from this episode? Paul, do you have one?
I like Michael's line, "Is that what I know it is?"
That was 100% a Wentworth line. I guarantee
about,
it.
T-Bag has a little piece of the map on him. He's clearly either eaten, destroyed it. He's eaten it. And Michael's disappointed. I liked that line.
Okay, my line, my favorite line is also from that scene, and I think it's right around the same time. It's where he says, "I would have tattooed it on my body, but I didn't have the time." I thought, I just,
a little.
I love it. The Michael T-Bag repartee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was lots of fun for me. Good question, though.
Okay. Alicia, A-L-E-A-S-H-A dot Wallace. As actors, do yourselves ever get starstruck by anyone you've ever worked with? Example, John Hurd. Also, follow-up, which is, I love this follow-up. Sarah, is that genuinely how you open all your mail? Which seems to be a little maybe judgmental, or at least noting something odd. That you, do you open your mail in an odd way? Because I didn't notice it.
I shake it down and open it from the short end. So if this is a letter, I shake it down and rip the top. Because I can't remember. Okay. I saw somebody do
Hawaii?
It once and it was, no, it's not a Hawaii thing. I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason for it. Also, remember how people used to have letter openers?
Yes, of course, my parents.
That was like a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You had a letter opener.
You
and if you wanted to give somebody a weird gift, you'd be like, "Here, I found this bone-handled letter opener in Wyoming for
picture
you."
Picture my parents' letter opener perfectly. I think they still have and use it.
No longer a thing. Yeah, no longer.
Oh, no,
a
my
thing.
Parents still talk about having to go through the mail. And
well, you pointed out during the rewatch that Sarah has a lot of mail.
Well, 99% of it is trash, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Look. I will periodically like just be in a store and find a card and mail it to a friend. And it's like the reaction is crazy. People act like I sent them a diamond necklace. It's wild.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have, Paul, is there anybody you've ever been starstruck to work with?
Yes, many times.
I mean, you just worked with Janet McTeer.
Many times. A lot of people, frankly, and you're like, thank God I'm acting. Because we have to pretend to do this scene. I find it particularly difficult if the status is reversed.
To play higher status than somebody that you admire.
I mean, I just did this thing with
Halle
Berry where I had to, like, I was her boss and I had to get, like, really mean to her. And it was like, what are you doing? You can't talk to Halle Berry that way.
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah, there's that thing is, and but you know, that's part of the fun, frankly. That challenge is part of the fun. What about you?
Yeah, although I think I prefer in some ways to work with people who are relatively unknown, because that, like, when we all show up together on the same playing field, I think it's nice.
I mean, to clarify, like, I was I was going to add, a lot of times people that have that kind of status in a work environment are very aware that they need to diffuse that.
They wear it
well.
Diffuse
it so that everyone's – I mean, Halle Berry was amazing at that. Like, we were just doing scenes, you know. I was nervous to work with Stacey Keach because I was such a fan of his for so long and he's so powerful. But he immediately put me at ease.
Oh, that's cool.
And John Hurt.
Yeah.
Like, I also
very
loved,
disarming.
Loved.
Yeah, I think I was I was intimidated but not starstruck.
Right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I think
like,
that's an actor
just because they had such long...
Yeah, it's the actor version of starstruck, though, right? I mean...
Well, just in terms of, like, I'm trying to think of people whose work I was, fangirling kind of a thing. And for me, Hugh Laurie, oddly, because I was such a fan of the British Jeeves and Wooster that he and Stephen Fry did. And I saw the two of them sitting together at a Golden Globes once and lost my effing mind. Yeah, an interesting question. This is the one I was telling you about during the rewatch. This is, like, I didn't even think it's a question.
So
it just slayed
Jess
me.
Spitzer?
At,
or Jess Pitzer?
Yeah. You want to read it?
J-E-S-S-P-I-T-Z-E-R. Was there ever any behind-the-scenes discussion about how the two most wanted men in America would try to change their appearances, but instead Michael and Lincoln were like, how attractive can we possibly be? Question mark. And then, just for good measure, she added, Link just kept losing buttons. Which is amazing. Maybe he felt like it would distract whomever was there. They wouldn't even recognize him because they'd just be so blown away by his chest.
I mean, it is a funny thing that she brings up that, like, Teabag dyes his hair and Tweener shaves his head and Michael puts on a ball cap.
And a suit.
And a suit. I just think it's a really funny question. Like,
I like that.
It's a funny comment, so I included it.
I love that
we don't need to, like, make a thing out of it.
I love that the show, like, Karen Usher talked about that when we had her on, talking about season one, where there was, like, that they would go on these incredible deep dives to get the verisimilitude of how a prison would work physically, right? But then, like, something electrical, they'd be like, yeah, we don't care if it's real.
And the Sparky goes to Sparky.
Goes,
like, when they're
like the water thing, and they're like, oh, we have no idea if that's real. Like, I love that about this show. I like that there's a some writers call it, like, the house of buys. Like, you're just gonna buy that.
Yeah.
Like, do you, because here's the thing.
What was it that
do you want to see Michael and Lincoln in disguises? I don't.
I mean, if they're full on,
but not for,
like, the Americans disguises,
I do. For maybe a scene.
No.
But not
I
want to
see Lincoln in a different wig
God.
And a different pair
different
of glasses
show.
Every week. Of course it's a different show. But I just want to be in the hair and makeup chair next to Dominic getting a wig pasted onto his head that's like a bald comb over, because it would be so much fun for me. It'd be so much fun for me. My favorite of this episode of the House of Buys is when they're talking about the Michael's hard drive that was recovered from the river outside his apartment, and the guy's like, "Yeah, with the something,
I mean, those,
with the something
those,
happened, the something."
I guarantee you that was real.
And Mahone was just like, "Shut up."
Just what do you
but
have?
Mahone's just like, "Nobody cares. I don't care. The audience doesn't
care.
Shut up. Just move on."
Like, well, we have a buffer. We got stuff from the
tech
buffer.
Boy. The buffer. All right, last question, I believe.
I do remember a director saying, I think this is in season four. Is that what I came back at the end of? Season four? Season four wrapped it up. Saying, could you button your shirt one, just one more up? I don't remember. It must have been Kevin Hooks, because no one else would talk to.
I think Kev would have had the guts to say that, yeah.
To Dom that way.
Here's our last question, and it's... I think it's really very sweet. At Planet Sarah 2024, I've wondered about this when shooting an episode. Does everyone go in at a certain time and stay the entire day? Or does each actor have a different time they have to be on set? I don't know if this makes sense. Like, after shooting your scene, can you go or would you stay and watch other cast members in action? So the simple question is, we all have a call time to be in hair and makeup in time to make it for our scenes. And when your scenes are done, then you can go.
But
sometimes, and this is part of why I thought this was an interesting question, like, you spend a lot of time shadowing other directors to hang out and kind of go to free film school and see how they did things.
I remember when I, like, Private Practice, I would just, like, hang out. Prison Break,
we did it on Walking Dead.
You just become, I think, in certain casts, also depending on, like, do you have a child to go home to? Or a spouse? Or, like, what, you know, are you out of town? Are you at home? There is a kind of, there can be a real camaraderie. And sometimes it's just people are like, I got to get out of here. But for instance, the scene where Tweener gets beat up by the guy, I somehow remember being there. I don't know if I was shooting later in that day. Mm-hmm. So I just went to set.
I kind of feel like maybe our church was like on the same location or something. It felt familiar to me too.
I also am not much of a trailer. I'm not a huge fan of the trailer, so I try to go out and get on set because it's more interesting.
Yeah. I remember certainly, like, Walking Dead, because at least in the first season, most of the cast was in most of the scenes. So even if you didn't have a line until after lunch, you'd be there. But there were also certain scenes as certain people emerged, you started to get to know their work. There were days where I was like, I'm not leaving until I watch Melissa do this scene. Yeah. Like, I don't know what she's going to do, but I'm going to learn something from it. And that's kind of fun. But yeah, for at Planet Sarah, the answer is you only have to be there for your scenes. And of course, you know, real gems of people will stay around for phone calls and, you know, to be on the other side of phone calls and off camera lines and things like that. And real assholes will leave once their coverage is shot and then leave you all alone. That happened to me on one of my very first jobs, and it blew my mind. I was like,
I have some stories about that.
Okay.
I think that's what we have time for today. Yeah, we are at our time. So we're going to keep working through these questions. We have others that we will have to get to in other episodes. Thank you for being here. Don't forget to subscribe to the Watch Party episodes and our Fan Fiction Fridays, which is on our Patreon. The link is on the show page, wherever you're listening right now. And here is our call-in question of the week.
Wait, can I time you out? I wrote one for this week, but maybe, well, because it's right there in the little script, but maybe we just do the LG question.
You do it.
Okay, what fan question, call-in question for this week. What do you think the LG stands for on Tweener's Lane Garrison's arm? We know what it really is. But yeah, on Tweeter's arm, what does the LG stand for? I'm going with Little Gangster. Paul, what's your best guess?
Loco Guero. I don't know.
What does that mean?
I don't know if Guero is a real word.
Maybe Crazy War?
Crazy War.
Guero?
The call-in line number, by the way, is 401-3-P-BREAK. That's 1-401-3-P-B-R-E-A-K. We'll play our favorite answers in a coming up episode.
I love it. All right. Well, thank you for listening. Please feel free to subscribe on Patreon for all the bonus stuff. And that'll be on the link in the show page wherever you're listening right now. Thank you very much. It was nice to spend another episode with you. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber
Your
Studio
hosts have been
production.
Inmates Sarah Wayne Callis and Paul Edelstein.
Our prison warden is producer
Front
Ben
man
Haber.
Of our jailhouse rock band is yours truly, Paul Edelstein, who made all our music.
Our prison yard tattoo artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato at Little Big Brands. Check him out at www.littlebigbrands.com.
Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at pbpodcast@caliber-studio.com. And call us at 401-3-P-BREAK.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Mahalo nui loa for listening.
Bye.
Prison Breaking. Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.